Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Michael Groden, professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at the Boston University School of Public Health, and professor of family medicine and psychiatry at the Boston University School of Medicine, as well as the director of the Project on Medicine and the Holocaust at the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. He'll speak on the topic Jewish Medical Resistance and the Ghettos and Camps During the Holocaust, which is also the title of his latest book. Dr. Groden's appearance was co-sponsored by Creighton University's Center for Health Policy and Ethics, the Philip M. and Ethel Klutznik Chair in Jewish Civilization, and the Institute for Holocaust Education. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 23, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Eileen Burke Sullivan, Vice Provost for University Mission and Ministry at Creighton University.
This evening's talk follows a long tradition of presentations by Jewish and occasionally Christian scholars who are experts in various aspects of Holocaust studies here at Creighton. They're part of a mission-centered reflection on the impulses and causes of terrible tragedies of human destruction by humans. We have chosen to do this through the years with an eye to challenging our students and the whole community that surrounds Creighton to be alert to sources of such impulses and to stop them before they become genocidal. At the same time, we are also proud to explore the generous and extraordinary impulses toward compassion and courage, even in the midst of terrible evil. These opportunities for reflection invite us to appreciate the moral imperatives that compel human persons to rise above darkness and witness to the light of human and divine goodness. And now it is a pleasure to invite my wonderful colleague, Dr. Leonard Greenspoon, the holder of the Philip M. and Ethel Klutznik Chair in Jewish Civilization for many years here at Creighton, to introduce our distinguished speaker. Leonard?
Thank you, Eileen. One of the things that we in the Omaha community take for granted is the incredible way in which we join together, bringing together strengths of various institutions. This is not something we really should take for granted, because I know of many other locales where universities are competing with each other, where different institutes hoard rather than share their resources. So it is that Dr. Groden, who has been in Omaha probably a little over 24 hours, has already spoken four times. And I don't think that counts. I don't know if you talk in your sleep. That may have been another one. But he spoke last night shortly after arrival at UNL, and today he spoke three times in the General University of Nebraska in Omaha environment, sponsored by the Schwab Center, sponsored by two parts of the Med Center. And then we come together, as Eileen said, with three different groups within Creighton and within the Jewish community. It is one of the things that's made me proudest that we can come together like this. Dr. Michael Allen Groden, who is the speaker, whom you've come to hear, is an MD, professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at Boston University School of Public Health, where he has received almost two dozen research and teaching awards over his 34 years of teaching at BU. In addition, he is at the Boston University School of Medicine, works very closely on a number of projects with Elie Wiesel and Elie Wiesel's Institute. Dr. Groden received his Bachelor of Science from MIT, his medical degree from Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and has done postdoctoral research at UCLA and Harvard. The list of Dr. Groden's current affiliations is very, very impressive. I think I probably got tired just reading it, and I figured out how he could do all of these things. I will just highlight a few of them. Dr. Grodin is the medical ethicist at Boston Medical Center. He is the co-founder of Global Lawyers and Physicians, Working Together for Human Rights, and co-director of the Boston Center for Refugee Health and Human Rights, Caring for Survivors of Torture. Missed all of the teaching and missed all of the community service, Dr. Grodin has offered over 600 presentations to scholars, specialists, and the general public in all the continents and many of the countries of the world. In addition, he has edited or co-edited 6 volumes, among them The Nazi Doctors and the Nuremberg Code, Human Rights in Human Experimentation, Children as Research Subjects, Science, Ethics, and Law. He has 2 books, one of which, Jewish Medical Resistance in the Ghettos and Camps During the Holocaust, which will be the topic of this evening's talk. Is that out yet? Okay, because the publicity I have, it's almost out. So it is out, available at bookstores and wherever fine books are sold. In addition, he's working on another book, After the Shoah, Rebuilding the Lives of Holocaust Survivors. It is my great pleasure to present to you Dr. Michael Grodin.
Well, thanks, Professor Greenspoon, for that generous introduction. I want to thank Liz Feldstern for inviting me and really being my chauffeur all around Omaha. I'd like to particularly thank you for reading my introduction, an introduction that my father would have been proud of and my mother would have actually believed. But we're actually going to talk about a very serious topic tonight. And I want to preface it by saying that it's a very difficult topic, and it should be a difficult topic. But I'm going to try to give you an overview of a number of areas, and as I move through them, you can ask me questions. We have ample time for a conversation, and I can focus on a number of areas. But my lecture this evening is a part of a much larger project at the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies focused on medicine during the Holocaust, which I've been involved with for about the last 35 years. I began my career as a psychiatrist over 35 years ago, working with Holocaust survivors and their families. And I was compelled by the question of resilience and why we're so much focused on pathology and not focusing on the resilience of survivors. And I began my clinical work focused on building survivors' strengths rather than their pathology. I then moved on from that work to a study of the Nuremberg Doctors' Trial and the Nazi doctors, and published a book with my colleague on the Nazi doctors and the Nuremberg Code. I then continued my research on Nazi medicine and its involvement, as we're going to see in a minute, with the racial hygiene movement, progressing to the so-called euthanasia or murder program, and ultimately to physicians' involvement in the genocide itself. And I published a piece on how was it possible for healers to become murderers? How is it possible for anybody to become a murderer, but how is it particularly possible for physicians, as we're going to learn, to become involved in genocide, sterilizations, euthanasia program, and selecting at the ramps. I then moved on to a study of rescuers and became very interested in the predictive factors of identifying rescuers. But most recently, and what I'm going to focus mostly on tonight, is I completed a research study on Jewish physicians and medical resistance in the ghettos and camps. My present book project, which we might want to talk a little bit about, is on rabbinic responsa, Jewish legal opinions that rabbis issued in the ghettos and in the camps, particularly those related to medical-related issues. But it's a fascinating, fascinating topic, and it's something that I've been very engrossed in over the last couple years. But tonight I'm going to talk about a remarkable and largely untold story of the Jewish physicians and their role in the ghettos and camps during the Holocaust. So I'm going to start by laying the background of medicine in the Third Reich and the role of the Nazi doctors as a prelude and it's a comparison as to what the Nazi doctors did as opposed to what the Jewish physicians did. These are pictures from the Palace of Justice in Nuremberg. This picture is taken some 70 years ago in 1945 after the camps had been liberated. At the time of this picture is being taken, 2 out of every 3 Jews of Eastern Europe have been murdered. 1 out of every 3 Jews in the world have been murdered. And 1.5 million children under the age of 14 had been murdered. Following the International Military Tribunal, which is the Nazi war criminals, there was a series of 12 U.S. trials, the judge's trial, the industrialist trial, but case one of those trials was the doctor's trial. The United States versus Karl Brandt. The Nazi physicians were tried for war crimes and crimes against humanity, for physician involvement in racial hygiene, sterilizations, child and adult euthanasia, and ultimately selection at the ramps and human experimentation. But some preliminary lessons. First of all, this is a difficult topic, and it's supposed to be difficult. It's a complicated topic. The more I study and work in the area of the Holocaust and Holocaust studies, the more questions arise and the more we learn. It's important to start with what was. And there are as many stories as there are survivors, but it's important to remember the Holocaust was man-made. Nothing is or was inevitable. People made choices, although we're going to see for the Jewish physicians, they were often choiceless choices, but people made decisions. And I will argue, and we can have a discussion about that, that there's no such thing as a bystander. People have intent, and people are, should be held responsible for what they do. The opposite of good, I would argue, is not evil, but indifference. And survival, survival itself is a form of resistance. So why study medicine in the Holocaust? To understand a watershed event in the history of the world and how medicine played a crucial role during the Holocaust. To study the ramifications of prejudice, racism, and stereotyping. To explore the dangers of silence and indifference in the face of human rights abuses. To examine the use and abuse of power, especially the role of technology and bureaucracy in Nazi medicine. To explain the roles and responsibilities of the Nazi doctors. And to recognize the exemplary role of the Jewish physicians and appreciate some contemporary parallels. But it's important to start before the Holocaust. We spend so much time on the death and destruction, we don't remember what was lost. And that was really critical. Jews lived in every, before the Holocaust, Jews lived in every country of Europe. 9 million Jews lived in 21 countries of occupied Nazi Germany. Poland had the largest Jewish population. Jews lived in small towns, shtetls, where they spoke Yiddish and had a vibrant culture with theater, with art, with music. Jews worked in all walks of life as farmers, as tailors, as doctors, as teachers. One of the important and interesting factors, and particularly when we talk about the rabbinic aspect, is that it's estimated that 50% of the 9 million Jews of Eastern Europe were observant. And so one of the things that we're going to see is to try to maintain their Jewishness, try to maintain their sense of identity. Jewish law was provided a sense of order, meaning, and sanctity. Now, under National Socialism, Germany was to become a healthy, vibrant organism, with a metaphor used by the Nazis, of full-blooded Aryans, and the doctors were mobilized to create this society. The Nazis needed the physicians to medicalize their racist ideologies, and the physicians needed the Nazis to carry out their eugenic plans. Physicians were called on to, quote-unquote, repair the state. Physicians formulated the theory, developed the plan, and initiated and administered policies. Policies imbued with social Darwinism, the idea of heredity being, everything was controlled by heredity. Physicians medicalized anti-Semitism and carried out the sterilizations. The sterilizations moved on to the child euthanasia program. Euthanasia is a euphemism, by the way, it was murder, which led to the adult euthanasia programs, deadly experiments, and then some of the physicians and nurses who had ran the gas chambers in the mental hospitals, in the hospital for children with retardation, moved and disassembled the gas chambers after they learned how to use the gas and moved them east to Poland, where physicians selected at the ramps who would live and who would die. The German eugenics movement emphasized social Darwinism, with concerns about the destruction of the natural struggle, secondary to medicine's differential increase in birth rates. In 1920, this is a very important book. By the way, the Nazis learned their eugenics from the U.S. The U.S. was far more advanced than the Nazis initially, and then the Nazis took over and became the leaders, obviously, of eugenics. But we see here the weight of the Volk by the handicapped. This is a book by Professor Carl Binding and Alfred Huck, a professor of medicine, a professor of law, entitled The Authorization of the Destruction of Life Unworthy of Life, Lebens und Werten Lebens, Life Unworthy of Life. In this book, we also find the notion that the Hippocratic tradition is seen as a vestige, quote-unquote, of ancient times. Physicians were no longer to consider the care of the individual patient, but to consider the health of the state over this valueless life. And these are some pictures from the American eugenics movement. The eugenics movement was international, especially in Britain and the U.S. Indiana passed the first sterilization law in 1907, and the U.S. has served as a model for early Nazi eugenics. This is Topeka, Kansas, fitter family clubs where white Anglo-Saxon Protestant good stock are given awards, and the immigrants and people are seen as degenerate. This is some people are born to be a burden on the rest, and you can see here the eugenic fair, the eugenic hereditary exhibit, eugenics building. Now, the Nazi doctors used metaphors to justify the destruction of the Jews as a form of racial hygiene. Jews were seen as diseased race, the source of infectious epidemics. Jews were parasites, a cancer to the Volk, and rotten appendix requiring removal. And here we have this microscope where the scientist, the physician, looks under the microscope and sees people, Jews, gay, capitalists, communists, and diagnoses these germs and then cures them through sterilization and through murder. The National Socialists transformed the German medical profession. The Nazis took control of professional organizations and restructured medical schools and the public health systems. By 1936, 46% of Berlin's non-Jewish physicians had joined the Nazi Party, by far and away above and beyond any other group. By the end of the war, almost half of all German physicians had joined the Nazi Party, and 7% had become members of the SS, the killing SS. Physicians were early signers up and were far more involved than any other professional group. Physicians were involved in the negative eugenics participation. This is the 1933 race hygiene sterilization law, the Nuremberg laws defining Jews and excluding them from citizenship, and then the euthanasia befell order by Hitler. Hitler actually signed this order, very rare. Hitler signed almost no documents. But this is the permission to conduct the euthanasia program. 350,000 to 400,000 people were sterilized through the Nazi sterilization courts, which were manned by three parties, a judge, and two physicians. One physician had to be an expert in eugenics. And through that, almost 400,000 people were sterilized. The Nuremberg Law for the Protection of German Blood and German Honor of 1935 defined Jews and limited their civil rights. And the T4 program, named after the code name after Tiergartenstrasse 4, was started in 1939 and was completed in August of 1941. Over 70,000 people were murdered as quote-unquote useless eaters. In fact, the physicians calculated if they killed 70,000 people that they would save so much food because they wouldn't have to feed them anymore. The sterilizations progressed. Here we have the Deutsches Ärzteblatt, which is the German Medical Association journal, which is still published. This is 1933. This is just when Hitler comes to power. And we already see the caduceus and the Nazi insignia. This is Tiergartenstrasse 4, the euthanasia center. Jews were then moved to ghettos, where they were to die of starvation and infectious disease. The ghetto was a prelude to transports to work camps, or to the death camps. And then the final solution of the so-called Jewish question, where physicians selected at the ramps who would go to the right and live and who would go to the left and would be sent to the gas chambers. Now, Jewish resistance took many forms, and I think that this is not understood enough. There was physical resistance, there was uprising in some of the ghettos, but there was also emotional resistance, there was spiritual resistance when we talk about the rabbis and how they helped people try to maintain their religious traditions. And there was a struggle to maintain one's Jewish identity. We're going to talk about the Jewish physicians and what they tried to do in the ghettos and camps to maintain health and to try to care for people where there were very little choices and where people were starving and dying. But it's important to note that before the ghetto, the formation of the ghetto, proper hygiene was essential to Eastern European Jews. And so we're going to see that the Nazis tried to talk about Jews being infected, and therefore they killed them based on the fact that they were carrying infectious agents. The Jews were actually had less infectious disease because of the Jewish tradition and the hygiene rules. Jewish laws regarding sanitation meant Jews were actually in a healthier state than the non-Jewish citizens. But what were some of the conditions in the ghetto like? Jews were locked in the ghetto with extreme overpopulation. There was a denial of access to medication. What little medication could be brought into the ghetto. Starvation in the ghettos was universal. Again, the Nazis' goal was to starve the entire ghetto in 9 months. The Nazis killed many of the trained health personnel and destroyed their equipment and facilities. We'll see that each ghetto is different. Each camp is different. Some ghettos had the hospital within the ghetto walls. Some had it outside the ghetto. It made a big difference in terms of what kinds of things could be done. But their equipment and facilities were often destroyed. Jews in the ghetto were denied soap, disinfectants, electricity, clean water. There was no garbage collection, no sewage management. All this in the face of the Jews' starvation and decreased host resistance. This is a propaganda. The Jew is infected with lice and therefore is a carrier of typhus. Ghettoization led to epidemics of infectious diseases. Typhus was caused by a body louse carrying rickettsia, which had a 50% mortality rate. For the Nazi doctors to study, so the Nazi doctors were concerned about typhus. In fact, they were obsessed about typhus. When they put up signs in the ghetto that there was typhus, the Nazis wouldn't come. But the other danger was that they would burn down the hospital if they knew that there was typhus there. But the Nazi doctors were tried to study typhus, but there was at that time, no culture media to maintain the organism so that they could study it. So they would infect concentration camp prisoners, one to the next, to have what they called human farms to be able to maintain the organism for research. Typhoid was caused by salmonella, caused by water contamination, by feces, which was secondary to having 30 people to a toilet in the ghetto. Jewish physicians conducted strict education on boiling water and washing hands. And, of course, there was a recrudescence and reinfection of tuberculosis, all things that the Jewish doctors tried to deal with and tried to manage. There was public health education. There was enforcement of bodily hygiene. Inspection of buildings and latrines. We're going to talk about the Vilna ghetto, which was a particularly good example of doctors who had been in the Vilna hospital. There were about 100 Jewish doctors, and that was incorporated in the Vilna ghetto. And they were very, very familiar with hygiene techniques. And they set up public health programs, remarkable. Epidemiological units, monitoring of each different housing area. They organized the inspection of buildings and latrines. They organized food distribution. So the Nazis gave a certain amount of ration to the people who were workers, enough so that they would be able to work. But then when they died, they would be replaced. But the Judenrat and the leaders of the ghetto and the physicians chose to take some of the ration that was given to the workers and give it to the poor, give it to the children, give it to people who were sick, a decision that had to be made. In terms of the justice questions. There were mandatory immunizations, there was quarantine when necessary, and the establishment of these sanitary control units. What were some of the ethical dilemmas faced by these Jewish physicians? Well, first of all, there was a question about whether one should identify oneself as a Jew, as a physician at all, but there was concern about prioritizing and triaging people who were very sick and they thought weren't going to live, where they should use what little medicine they had on that person or wait and treat to somebody who had a better prognosis, a classic triage problem. The falsification of medical records, particularly for the Jewish physicians that worked in the camps. Prioritization of one's family or patients and how one decided about that. Establishing policies and treatment of pregnancies and abortions. The Nazis declared any woman who became pregnant was to be killed. She was killed, if she delivered a child, the baby was killed as well. Allocation of limited resources and participation in selection for work. So there had to be a question about who would be sent to work, and if you didn't get sent to work, you'd be killed. The doctors worried about how they might comfort patients in these horrible situations. The question of stealing food. We're going to see the children were the heroes, the children who are able to get out of the fence and get out of the ghetto and go and get food and bring it into the ghetto, or even in certain cases go to the Polish pharmacists who are able to give some medicine and they were able to bring it into the ghetto. Trying to rescue Jews when assisting the Nazi doctors. Research, and the doctors studied starvation, studied infectious disease in terms of trying to understand how to improve the health measures. And then the participation in the Judenrat, or the Jewish Council, which we'll talk about, this very difficult position of the person, the group between the Nazis and the ghetto, and trying to make decisions about prioritization and working with the Nazis or are trying to sabotage what they were about. There was widespread starvation. The question of allocation of food, of sharing food. Physicians made decisions about care and triage of the ill. Along with the high mortality came questions about respect for the dead, very important in Jewish law, burial and how to cope with loss, the control and treatment of typhus and other infectious diseases, the lack of medicine and therapies for otherwise treatable diseases, things that could have been treated very easily, but there was no medicine, there was no ability to treat, and weighing the welfare of the individual versus the welfare of the community. Again, from the vestige of the Hippocratic times, the Nazis wanted you to treat not the individual, but treat the folk, the state. And so the question was, how much could you weigh the welfare of the individual versus the welfare of the community? Jewish physicians, nurses, and allied professionals established public health policies for sanitation, for sewage, for housing and work. Health professionals debated providing a comfortable death or to use scarce resources to keep patients alive. Health professionals established the use of disinfection within the ghettos. Questions came up around suicide, about martyrdom, so-called Kiddush Hashem, whether one should martyr oneself, and there was questions asked of the rabbis about that, which we can talk about. But the question of suicide is forbidden in Jewish law, and so the question was whether to allow it and what to do about it. Caring for German soldiers and German civilians who often wanted the Jewish doctors to treat them. Of course, that could be a dicey problem. And complying with the Nazis regarding medical procedures. The Warsaw Ghetto was established between October and November of 1940. It was the largest of the Jewish ghettos, a self-contained city of over 400,000 Jews in 1.2 square miles, with a population density of over 200,000 persons per square mile and 9.2 persons per room. 9.2 persons per room. Health was the responsibility of the Judenrat. As I mentioned, smugglers, especially children, played a crucial role in bringing food and supplies into the ghetto. People were forced to survive, I put in quotes, on less than 300 calories of food a day. The ghetto was liquidated in April of 1943. There were two hospitals in the Warsaw Ghetto. The Sisti Hospital was originally located outside the ghetto, and it was moved within the ghetto walls by Dr. Stein. The Bersan and Bauman Children's Hospital was located within the boundaries of the original ghetto, and Dr. Brada Heller served as the medical director. Some of the responsibilities of the physicians included establishing health policies and protocols, while some served as members of the Judenrat. Physicians tried to find ways to provide for orphans and anyone that could not care for themselves. Physicians organized and provided medical services as much as they could. In the hospital, they tried to set up mental health institutions, nursing facilities, clinics. Physicians directed medical research in the ghetto. But people were starving, and a hunger disease was a major, major problem, the disease of being malnourished and starving. Hunger disease research was performed by Jewish physicians, or a collection of data, in documenting the physiological and anatomical changes resulting from starvation. The physicians who expected to die themselves wanted to leave their research records. Sadly, this is the most comprehensive study of starvation ever recorded. In fact, one of the things they learned was that starvation causes starving of the muscle of the heart, and when you refeed people, they go into heart failure. And so this was a concern right after the war, right during liberation and the refugees also. Incredible, there was a medical and nursing school set up in the Warsaw Ghetto. A medical and nursing school, you can imagine. There was an underground medical and nursing school to continue education. The doctors wanted to continue their education. The school provided training of doctors in the hospitals. There were education about how to treat patients without any medicine because there were no medicines and there were no supplies. And so this was what they did in terms of trying to educate. This is the doctor who was the head of the public health department in the Warsaw Ghetto. He struggled with choosing whether to comply with the Nazis to help improve the lives of the population or to join the resistance and become a partisan. The problem, of course, is that if somebody became a partisan, they would kill your family. Okay? So you have to realize resistance meant putting not only yourself at risk, but your family at risk, your children at risk, and maybe even the whole community at risk. He struggled with choosing to comply with whether to comply with the Nazis or to help improve the lives of the population or to join the resistance. He was forced to make incredible resource allocation decisions, again, as a member of the head of the public health department. Dr. Schwajar created a playroom to comfort the children, so she was a pediatrician and very interested in children and had to deal with these children who were in the ghettos and ultimately in the camps. She tried to comfort children dying of tuberculosis and other diseases. Ultimately, she injected children with morphine in an attempt to avoid more painful deaths, an incredibly heart-wrenching story. She eventually contracted typhus herself. Dr. Mordechai Lenski made decisions about who would work in the labor camps and who would receive exemptions. The Vilna Ghetto, which is one of the most incredible stories, because they actually were successful in controlling epidemics. The Vilna Ghetto was located in occupied Republic of Poland. The ghetto was established in early September of 41. The inhabitants were forced to work in and outside the ghetto. So that was good and bad. When you worked outside the ghetto, you would also be, even if they could control things within the ghetto, then there would be diseases that would come in from the outside. And so there was a big tension between allowing people, trying to find work within the ghetto versus going out of the ghetto and be alive and bring things into the ghetto. There was a Jewish hospital in the Vilna Ghetto, and physicians developed an elaborate public health system to ensure sanitation and hygiene. Physicians organized sanitary districts with sanitary brigades and established an outpatient clinic. Ultimately, there were mass killings before the ghetto was liquidated in September of 1943. Medical care and public health included creating health care facilities, hospitals, and a sanitary police force. Mass disinfection and inoculations were administered. Materials were brought in from outside the ghetto at the risk of life. Physicians conducted constant examinations. They created vitamins. They tried to make vitamins by taking horse marrow and create vitamins out of that. They took distillery. There was a brewery distillery, and they took waste from that to try to develop enriched vitamins for the children. There were populations, daily examinations, which took place in overcrowded parts of the ghetto, mass public baths and laundries. Physicians organized and provided preventative information, and there were these little signs that were put up about lectures that were going to be given, what to do about bed bugs. There was one famous one, don't pick your nose. There was another one that said, you know, what to do when your child is yellow and scared. But they went from courtyard to courtyard and from house to house, and they constructed secret rooms to study and examine people who were sick. They struggled with how the sanitary police should work and tried to keep the ill from entering the hospital because they did not want to give the Nazis a reason to destroy it, and that had happened in many ghettos. The physicians in the ghetto conducted research on anemia, surgical disease, and vitamin deficiency. And this is interesting. This is the organizational chart of the Vilna Ghetto. So you can see how organized they became with house guards, watchmen, block guards, sanitary youth auxiliary distributing food rations. And this is a card where if you went to you needed to go to the disinfection center to be checked by the doctor. And if you did, then you got this cart which gave you a ration of food. So they linked the sanitation to the rations for food. Rather amazing and creative. To ensure compliance with sanitation and disinfection protocols. The Kovno Ghetto, which is where Rabbi Oshri was a 28-year-old rabbi and issued rabbinic decisions, which we can talk about, but a very important ghetto, was established in July and August of 41 in Lithuania. There are 29,000 Jews, so it was a smaller ghetto. which was comprised of small primitive houses, many having no running water and bathing facilities or sewers. Each person had less than 10 square feet of living space. The Jews were forced into labor, and the ghetto was evacuated in 1944. The Judenrat were Jewish councils elected by the community or chosen by the Nazis to act as the ghetto's leadership. Many Judenrat contained doctors, such as in the Kovno ghetto. The Judenrat made major decisions about logistics of the ghetto, including health, work, food, allocation, hygiene, care for the orphans and the poor. And the Judenrat particularly struggled with the dilemma of whether to comply with Nazi orders or to resist them by putting everybody at risk. Elkanan Elkis, who was a physician, was the head of the Kovno Judenrat, and he negotiated with the Nazis in an attempt to save Jewish lives. He literally negotiated with each person that came through to try to gain their life. He consulted and appointed doctors and lawyers. He tried to create medical normalcy, whatever that means, in the ghetto through workshops on sanitation and health care. The possibility of prioritization of one's family, whether the Judenrat should try to negotiate with the Nazis in an attempt to save more Jews or maybe be killed. They worried about how to create new ideas to keep work within the ghetto where it was safer rather than sending Jews to work outside the ghetto. And they struggled about how to encourage good hygiene. Now, there were also Jewish physicians in the camps. Very different discord. There were many different camps. There were there were death camps, you know, the so-called Reinhardt camps. Then there were camps that were work camps as well as concentration, as well as death camps. Auschwitz III was to work for IG Farben. Jewish physicians also had a role in the camps. Auschwitz I, II, and III was established and operated between 1940 and 45. It was the largest camp and included a concentration camp and an extermination camp. 1.1 million people were murdered, 90% of them Jews, and Auschwitz was liberated in January of 45. This is a picture of Block 10 in Auschwitz, which is where the Nazis carried out their sterilization studies, horrendous sterilization studies, again, as part of their eugenic quality. Physicians were asked to work in those settings. I'm going to try to show you a film of Survivor.
We marched together with our mother and many other people. We were marched to a cattle car train.
When the doors were opened, I could almost feel the cold air coming in and the German officers shouting, "Raus, raus, schnell, schnell."
We were together for about 4 months, I believe, at which time there was an action called, and a few twins and perhaps some doctors and nurses were separated, and Renee and I were at that time separated from our mother. I can only recall a soul-piercing cry from our mother, and I know we didn't want to let go, but we were forcibly taken from her. And then we were also separated from each other. It was only later on that we learned that that entire lager, that 3,700 people were all killed that night, our mother among them.
When I got to the infirmary, what I remember is I always had to get undressed and being put between two cold plates, which I know were called Röntgen machines. I think that's X-ray. And measured and weighed and poked and pushed.
I remember going to Mengele specifically. Actually, the very first time that we went to the doctor was when our mother was still with us, so we were still in the Czech Vermilion Lager. And I remember it especially because I was only concerned that Renee would cry and something terrible would happen to him. And I have recollections of blood being taken from my neck and my arms. I hate doctors. The blood from the neck was extremely painful, extremely painful. But I knew I couldn't cry, and I didn't. I never cried.
We'll come back to that.
I also was motivated to keep myself going by the fact that I knew that she was somewhere out there. I even saw her once. I think we saw each other once through a fence or two fences. Nothing was said. We just saw each other and we knew we were alive and always had that feeling that she was alive. Always. Never left. And everything that happened afterwards was just done basically so I could meet up with Irene.
We'll come back to the child survivors. Most of the survivors today were children. That was 7 years ago. And so we'll talk a little bit, if you're interested, in my clinical work. Again, has been caring for survivors for 35 years. And there's a very big difference. Each survivor has his unique story, a unique experience. Most of them have done quite well. But there's obviously a difference between an adult who goes through the camps versus a child who is hidden, who is given a different identity, and children of survivors and grandchildren of survivors. So we can talk about that. These were some of the Jewish doctors that worked in Block 10. Dr. Gisela Pearl was a Jewish gynecologist in Auschwitz who provided abortions and helped pregnant women secretly deliver babies. She would often have to euthanize the babies. There were situations where baby would cry, and if they were found, then the Nazis would kill everybody. She carried out her work despite the fact she had no tools or medical supplies. Miklos Nietzsche was a pathologist in the camp. He performed autopsies upon those who died during Nazi research and performed autopsies. He falsified the death certificates of many people to try to hide contagious diseases and to prevent the liquidation of the barracks in which they would be exterminated. So that's the difference between the Nazi doctors and the Jewish doctors. The doctor's role is always to heal, whether that be to lend a helping hand, whether that be to comfort, whether that be to listen. I began my work with Holocaust survivors, and I've been interested in resiliency and the issue of how do people deal with trauma. And then I became interested in perpetrators and did a book on the Nazi doctors and the Nuremberg trials. Then I said, gee, I've been doing all this. Why don't I work on the doctors, the Jewish doctors, try to put together in one place all the documents and all the histories, all the stories, all the interviews of Jewish doctors in the ghettos and camps during the Holocaust.
When I came to college, the reason I came to BU was to do medical ethics, and specifically Jewish medical ethics. And when I came to Dr. Grodin, I really didn't know very much about Jewish doctors and the Holocaust. So we just started reading and reading and reading and talking to a lot of Holocaust scholars to try and find these texts because they are few and far between in English.
The physicians that were involved in the Holocaust did not write in general after the war. There was kind of a general conspiracy of silence. Many of them had a lot of guilt about what had happened and what went on during that time. And a lot of concern that people wouldn't understand the horrible decisions that they had to make under incredible circumstances.
Dr. Gisela Pearl was a gynecologist during the Holocaust in Auschwitz. I think her story was the most poignant for me.
We were given no medicines, no instruments. The fever-ridden patients shivered on the bare planks without blankets. Lice crawled over their bodies, carrying germs from one to the other.
Gisela Pearl was an incredibly resilient woman. She was able to do the abortions and even the killing of the newborns.
There was just no chance of survival, and the mother would be killed. So mothers that somehow hid their pregnancy until that point, she still aborted those children.
No one will ever know what it meant to me to destroy these babies. After years and years of medical practice, childbirth was still to me the most beautiful, the greatest miracle of nature. I love those newborn babies. not as a doctor, but as a mother, and it was again and again my own child whom I killed to save the life of a woman.
You have zero resources. You know that the fact that you are trying to save somebody else makes you less likely to survive.
But she did what she had to do, and she was able to give hope, hope in the place of no hope.
God was good to me. By a miracle, every one of these women recovered and was able to work, which, at least for a while, saved her life.
Physicians found themselves in every place that other Jews found themselves, whether it be in the ghettos, in the camps, but they had a special role to play and a special obligation to try to help rather than to be bystanders. There were hospitals in the Warsaw Ghetto. There was a medical school that was established, places where you can imagine they tried to maintain normalcy. And so the Warsaw Ghetto Hospital was a remarkable place where they had inadequate facilities, inadequate equipment, inadequate medications, and yet they tried to do whatever they could with whatever they had.
What they had was the ability to try and convince their patients that it was their lives would go on, that this was a stage.
People looked up to the doctors. And so if the doctors were able to carry on, then perhaps in some way they were able to carry on as well.
The letter that Dr. Elks wrote to his children after he had them smuggled out of the ghetto, I think, is the text that stands out most in my mind. Dr. Elkanon Elks, he was the head of the Judenrat in Kovna, in the Kovna ghetto. A lot of doctors were placed in these positions of power within the ghettos, especially whenever the Nazis were doing actions, so picking out people who would live and who would die. He would stand there for hours and hours and try and negotiate for each individual person to be kept alive.
One of the issues was who would be able to get back to work, because that was their life. If you couldn't work, you'd be killed. And so a decision had to be made.
I am the man who with my own eyes saw those about to die. With my own ears, I heard the awe-inspiring and terrible symphony, the weeping and screaming of 10,000 people, old and young, a scream that tore at the heart of heaven.
And so he wrote this letter to his children that he'd had smuggled out of the ghetto. He just writes about how the only thing that brings him and his wife any comfort as they're sitting starving to death in the ghetto is fantasizing about how his children are going to grow up and the fact that they will grow up and who they're going to be.
Our innermost desire is to see you again, to embrace you, and tell you once again how close we are to you and how our hearts beat as we remember you and see you before us. As we stand here at the very gates of hell with a knife poised at our necks, only your images, dear ones, sustain us.
This letter was also smuggled out to his children that he never ever saw again. For me, I think what was so compelling about this project was that specific medical ethics, how Jews during the Holocaust made these decisions, how their professions influenced them.
We can never, nor should we ever, hopefully be in the situation to have to make the kind of decisions they made. The most important thing that I've learned is that there is an incredible will to maintain one's dignity and one's sense of self. So the present work that I've been focusing on is under the category of what I call medical halakha, or Jewish law, and rabbinic response in the ghettos. Responsim are Jewish shilas and shuvas, are Jewish legal decisions issued by rabbis. During the Holocaust, they were a remarkable form of Jewish spiritual resistance, what I call Jewish spiritual resistance. The unique circumstances of the Holocaust required the most challenging interpretations of Jewish law. Again, it was estimated that in 1933, 50% of Eastern European Jews were religious and followed Jewish law. And therefore, rabbinic law and rabbinic decisions allowed Jews to remain Jewish despite these circumstances. By the way, this is Chaim Ephraim Oshri, who was the rabbi of the Kovno ghetto. Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grodzinski was my great-grandfather. He was a very famous rabbi in the Polish. But these are some of the rabbis who issued responses. They had to survive the Holocaust. Rabbi Oshri wrote down his response to his decisions on cement sacks and then hid them, not knowing whether he would survive or not. He survived the Holocaust, went back and got those, retrieved those, and ultimately published his response in the volumes. He didn't have access. In order to write these responses, not only do you usually need colleagues to talk to, but you need to have sephorim, you need to have Jewish legal books in order to make decisions. And Rabbi Oshri was very, very privileged to be able to use books to actually write his response. There were no other ghettos that had books. So why were there books in the Kovno ghetto? It's because the Nazis collected a series of books that was going to be a museum to show to people about an extinct race. And it turned out that because there was these books, he was able to actually use the books and use them for responsive. Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Meisel survived. Rabbi Shimon Efrati, Rabbi Yehuda Aronson. These are very, very incredible rabbis. So just to give you a flavor for some of the questions that were asked, they became more desperate as time proceeded. So can you milk a cow on Shabbos? It's obviously early on in the. But is it permissible to hold concerts or public lectures on secular topics in a synagogue? Jews were restricted from going outside of the Jewish area. And so the question was, could you do secular events within the synagogue? And Rabbi Oshri said yes. Shaving one's beard to avoid attention about the Nazis. The issue of saving a life, pekuach nefesh, trumps most other issues. But the question was, the Jews felt uncomfortable doing that. Performing a C-section, there was a woman who was shot by the Nazis who was pregnant. And the question was whether you could do a C-section to try to save the fetus. But there was a question of whether she was dead or not. And, of course, why you can't kill to save. Can a woman whose husband has disappeared remarry after the war without evidence of death? So the question of eating non-kosher food was an interesting question. And the answer, you should all know, of course, is that you, not only can you eat non-kosher food, you must to save your life. So that wasn't the question. That couldn't be the question. The question they asked the rabbi was, is there a special blessing we should say over the non-kosher food? The question was, if you martyred yourself, Kiddush Hashem, martyred yourself in the name of God, whether there was some blessing you should say, or what blessing should you say to be a martyr? Incredible. The sterilization law of 1933, how should you deal with the sterilization law? Questions at the beginning of life around contraception, about pru or vu, having children. Questions at the ends of life, including death, dying, burial. Again, Kiddush Hashem, which was martyrdom. Questions of triage, so that they were given cards, and the question that was asked of the rabbi, if you had a card, you would go to work. If you didn't, you'd die. And so the question was it acceptable to hand out cards and make essentially judgments about who would live and who would die? So some conclusions. Jewish doctors were forced to make choiceless choices. Jewish doctors embodied what it means, in my view, to be a health professional. And this is truly an untold story of the heroes of Jewish resistance. And so let me close with a quote from the Nuremberg Doctors Trial. In the words of Brigadier General Telford Taylor at the Nuremberg Doctors Trial, he said, "It is our deep obligation to all peoples of the world to show why and how these things happen. It is incumbent upon us to set forth with conspicuous clarity the ideas and motives which move these defendants to treat their fellow men as less than beasts. The perverse thoughts and distorted concepts which brought about these savageries are not dead. They cannot be killed by a force of arms. They must be cut out and exposed for the reasons so well stated by Mr. Justice Jackson in this courtroom a year ago. The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored, because it cannot survive their being repeated." And so I dedicate this lecture to the Jewish physicians, physicians who strive to save lives in the face of death and destruction, and to treat their patients and community with dignity and compassion. May their memory be a blessing. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Michael Groden, professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at the Boston University School of Public Health, and professor of family medicine and psychiatry at the Boston University School of Medicine, as well as the director of the Project on Medicine and the Holocaust at the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. He spoke on the topic, Jewish Medical Resistance in the Ghettos and Camps During the Holocaust, which is also the title of his latest book. Dr. Groden's appearance was co-sponsored by Creighton University's Center for Health Policy and Ethics, the Philip M. and Ethel Klesnick Chair in Jewish Civilization, and the Institute for Holocaust Education. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 23, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.